Pleasure and privilege to have a chance to talk to Jean Bacon, who I've known on and off for some years now. Jean, I always start by asking when and where you were born.
I was born in 1942 in a small town in the Pennines called Stocksbridge, between Sheffield and Manchester. Lived in a village till I was six, a very small village, just up the hill from the town. So I started hill walking as soon as I was able to walk.
You still like walking, I think.
Yes, we take walking holidays in the mountains and look for flowers and so on. I think that started from my pushchair.
Your pushchair was filled with flowers, actually.
My mother had to stop and let me pick them in those days.
Lovely. Okay, well, let's start with your parents or your grandparents. You can go back as far as you like. I mean, significant people who you knew. Did you know your grandparents generally?
No, they died when I was very young. So they came from very working class backgrounds, quarryman, stone quarryman in Greenmoor, where I lived for 6 years, and steel worker, coke ovens in the steelworks. Those are the grandparents, the grandfathers. So very heavy, heavy, hard lives, heavy work. And my father worked in the steelworks all his working life.
That's interesting. Tell me something about his character and his influence on you.
My father was a very, very quiet person, so very self-contained. And he wasn't extrovert. He signed the pledge because his father drank when he was at home with him. So he signed the pledge in the temperance movement in the north. So I think both my father and my uncle did this. And so he's Methodist teetotaler.
I was wondering about his religion. Yes, there are a lot of Protestant sects and so on up there.
Yes. And my mother, also a very quiet person, and I felt it's tragic that she was never able to work, because she did a job like taking the milk round when she was young, and it was terribly depressed in those days. So I guess we're talking about the 1920s. I suppose when you got married, you had to stop working anyway at that time. I think she's very, very bright, and she's 91 now.
Still around.
I think she could have done so much given the chance, and she always says, "Oh, I loved school."
But she left when she
was 15. She had to leave very early, so did my father. He left about age 14 to be an apprentice in the steelworks.
Did either of them have sort of at all intellectual interests? Did you discuss ideas with them, or religion, or anything else?
No, not of that kind, really. When you said intellect, I thought, well, the opera, they did Gilbert and Sullivan and that kind of thing, the local, local group. And the chapel was very small. There'd be sort of concert party type things, but nothing very intellectual.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
No, I'm an only child.
What did your mother do? I mean, bringing up an only child, I suppose there must have been quite a lot of time. Or was it just cooking and looking after your father?
I think it was very much looking after us, and she still does this. It's always put the food in front of you as soon as you get in, she still does this.
Was she, like your father, a quiet sort of person?
I think she was almost made to be quiet because of my father, and since he's died, about, when was that, 18? I don't quite remember, 13 years ago, say. She's done much more socially in the chapel, that's been her life since then.
So, do you remember your first school?
Yes, Greenmoor Primary School. There were two classes, the young and the up to 6 or 7, the infant and the junior, basically, and I left when I was ready to go to the junior. Yes, I remember the primary school teacher.
Who was that?
She was called Miss Henson. I think she was a supply teacher, but she was very nice, very kind. And I remember being very much more advanced in the mathematics when I went to the big school in Stocksbridge, down in the bigger town. So they must have taught us something.
So she was a good mathematics teacher.
Yes, must have been.
And did you show an early interest in mathematics?
I think I did. I used to ask for sums to, write me some sums.
Really? At what age?
It was before I moved at the age of six.
Really?
Yeah.
Because Peter Swinnerton Dyer told me a nice story about how his, the only thing that could calm him in the bath when he was two was his mother giving him
Psalms.
Psalms.
Yes, yes.
You were the same?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So drawing in Psalms at that stage, yes.
So you begin already, I mean, you're an artist now, but at that age you were already drawing.
I think I always liked drawing, yes. Mm. I always liked picking flowers and I always liked drawing, and the two came together for some of the painting I did.
Mm. So, after that first school, where did you go to school?
Down in the town in Stocksbridge, and then I took the 11 plus and went to Pennystone Grammar School.
Mm.
And they put me through a year early, so I got to grammar school at age 10.
Mm.
And they had one of these accelerated programs, so that the A stream got to the sixth form in one fewer years. So I ended up in the sixth form at age 14, and then sort of had to cool my heels for ages and not quite know what to do. And
so you took your, I don't know what they were called at that time,
O levels,
GCSE,
yeah, GCSE
O levels.
Now. Mm-hmm.
When you were how old?
Well, 14. Yes.
Mm. Were you beginning to show particular interest or ability in maths and other subjects?
Yes, I'd always put maths as a top subject at that time, and I always went to the art rooms even when I couldn't do art classes. I think nowadays I'd be the sort of person who probably did double maths, English and art, but at that time you had to do sciences or arts, so I did double maths and physics.
Mm. So you could only do art as a kind of
just
hobby.
As a hobby, yes.
Yeah. Were there any teachers at that school who particularly...
They were very good teachers, yes. There was Mr. Stone who did physics, there was Mr. Whitehouse who did mathematics, there was Mr. Senior who did mathematics when Mr. Whitehouse left. There was a very stern and fierce headmaster when I first went there called Mr. Bowman, and his wife did the maths courses for the scholarship. Girls and boys, I suppose. And so, yes, I think they were very good teachers.
It was a mixed grammar school?
It was a mixed grammar school, yes.
Mm.
And in fact, we still have reunions, so my particular year meets every couple of years, even now.
And have any of them gone on to aspire to the heights that you aspire to?
I don't know. There are a few. Yeah, there are some academics and monsters and lots of interesting people.
Mm. Was it a sort of grammar school that, as has been the case in some interviews, where it's just assumed you might go to university, but probably not, and if you did, you certainly wouldn't attempt Oxford or Cambridge or anything?
I think Oxford and Cambridge scholarships were always a possibility, and other than that, it seemed to be training, teacher training college, and not much else in the way of what you might do. And I didn't try for Oxford or Cambridge because of this getting to the sixth form at age 14, feeling a bit kind of bulgy and independent and not wanting to hang around and take scholarships. So I got a place at, a scholarship at Royal Holloway, London University, and went there in 1960.
Mm. Well, just going back to the school, what were your hobbies apart from, you were probably still looking for flowers and painting, but were any others? Games? Music?
Oh no, I hate sport. I've no aptitude for hitting moving objects at all. I've never been terribly musical in that when you play an instrument, you're never good enough to... I didn't feel I was any good at it or good enough to sound all right.
But you love listening to it?
Yes.
Because your house is very well...
Yes.
At least the one, yes. Your holiday home is very well kitted out for listening to music, as I know.
That's right. Yes.
So what kind of music do you most like?
I always particularly like Mozart and Beethoven, late quartets, and Schubert quartets, and lots of other stuff as well.
It's often thought that music and mathematics have some kind of affinity in the manipulation of abstract symbols and so on. Does music affect your work in any way?
No, I'm an exception to this because, as I say, I think I'm a mathematics plus English plus art person rather than a scientist, really, deep down.
That's interesting. So is there a connection between your mathematics and your art?
I don't know. Probably not. I just think that the way music communicates emotion is strange, and the way colours talk to you, I think, is also strange, and it's all in the same domain.
Mm.
You know, the relationships between sort of as frequencies, I suppose, abstract pigments and frequencies in the music. And there's something that communicates mood to you without you knowing how.
Mm. Those two communicate mood, but they don't overlap at all with mathematics.
Not for me, no.
Mm. Mm. And what about other things at that age? People often go through a religious crisis, for instance. You're brought up in a Methodist home. Did you begin to question your faith or anything?
Yes, very much so. Being a bit counter-suggestible all the time, I think, all the way through. But yes, you certainly question everything.
Mm. And what came out of the questioning?
I think for a long time it made me anti-dogma and anti-church. And as I've got older, going back a bit, I didn't have my son baptised because I felt, you know, you shouldn't impose this on them in their babyhood and they should make their own minds up later. But I regret this now because he wishes I'd just done it. So that he didn't have to decide, and I never thought of angles like that at the time.
Mm. But now, what do you go to church? Or?
I don't go regularly, no, but I like going into churches. I love looking at old buildings. And
live next to a beautiful church.
Beautiful church, yes. Life. I had an exhibition in there in 2007 and sat there from 9 till 6 for a fortnight. And loved it. And painted the poppy heads on the pews and the font. And
this is Blythburgh.
This is Blythburgh Church.
With the wonderful angels on the roof.
Beautiful angels, yes.
Mm.
Yes.
But if you had to describe yourself, what would you describe yourself as?
Religious wise.
Hmm.
I couldn't say I was atheistic because I feel. I don't want organisation of religion, but I can't dismiss there is some spirituality, but it is all to do with the human race, and I'm not sure what the role of the human race is in the great scheme of things.
Mm.
I don't know how much longer it has left anyway.
So you don't, there's a feeling of some sort of spirit or something there, but not fixed on a...
I think there's a feeling that sometimes if you're at a funeral or something like this, you rise above anything petty, and there's some kind of feeling there that you want the greater good for the person.
Mm.
And I think that must be kind of what's behind religion in a way.
Mm.
And I've known, come across my husband's cousin's husband is a priest, and I feel that he's done a great deal of good.
Mm. What do you feel about this current controversy that's blown up, particularly in the last few days, about the fact that religion and science can't mix, people like Dawkins and so on saying that they are, if you're a scientist you can't be religious.
What I take from religion is the interpersonal interactions and however you describe them, whether it's religious or just, well, it's kind of like going back to music, how do you communicate what's going on?
Mm.
I sometimes feel that Ken and I read each other's minds, there's some telepathy going on, and I think there's something like that. But I think some people aren't like that, and they're the people who might say that everything has to be factual and dogmatic and cut and dried, and there is no evidence for faith, there's no evidence for a deity, and therefore that's it.
Mm.
And other people are more kind of woolly.
I'm sure. Mm.
Yes.
Okay, well, let's move on to Royal Holloway. What did you go to study?
Mathematics.
You'd done... I suppose it was AS, was it?
Yes, I did AS in Maths and Physics.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Why did you choose Royal Holloway?
It was sort of suggested to me. With hindsight, I should have gone to the centre of London, I think, to a mixed college. Because having been at a kind of robust northern grammar school, going to a women's college in London that was 20 miles out or so. Seems a silly thing to do, really.
Does it diminish your enjoyment of?
Yes, I felt I didn't really get what I should have out of university life.
What about the work itself? Was that okay?
The work was okay, but I had come across computing and computers through doing vacation jobs, and it was mentioned at school, and there was no opportunity for any statistics or any computing at all in the course, so it was very much the classical mathematics. So I didn't want to stay on and do an MSc or a PhD or anything like that at that stage.
You'd come across computing at school, so that when was that?
What this was the late 50s, so it was just mentioned. It wasn't, it was just, oh, this is the kind of job you might do, mentioned in a maths lecture. So it must just have been a chance.
You'd never seen a computer?
Oh, no, not at that stage, no.
And your holiday jobs didn't get you in touch with a computer?
This is between 1960 and 1963 at United Steels in Sheffield. I think it must have been 61. And there was Stafford Beer was doing work study there, and they were very much into cybernetics. And they did, I think they may have used a university computer, or they were about to get a computer. But they sent me on a course at Sheffield University just for a couple of days. And I thought, oh, I can do this, it's very easy. So that's, I suppose, the first exposure I had to.
So that was 63, 62, 63?
I graduated in 63, so it must have been 61 or 62, yes.
When you say you could do something, were you doing a sort of elementary programming in Fortran?
It was what I call now assembly-level programming, so it's how the machine works. So not a theoretical model at all, no. It was a very hands-on, moving bits about in registers.
But you not only could do it, but were, found it rather intriguing and fun.
Yes, very much so, yes, the potential of it. So, yeah, so that caused me to go to the National Physical Laboratory for my first job.
Just finishing on the university, were, there weren't any teachers at all, either Royal Holloway or elsewhere, who, or books or anything that really influenced you as a, an undergraduate?
I think, no, because... I mean, we had some very good lecturers, very good specialists. Professor McCrae was a relativity specialist, and I did that option. But nothing to make me want to carry on doing that for the rest of my life, or even any number of years subsequently.
Yeah. So, you, what degree did you get at the end of it?
I got a 2-1.
And weren't tempted to stay on, so what was the next move?
I went to the National Physical Laboratory in Teddington.
Teddington?
Yes.
Yeah. Tell me about that.
I was in mathematics division, and I came across the people who'd work with Alan Turing after the war. So this was some 10 years later, or more, 15 years later perhaps.
He was dead 63. By then.
Oh yes. Yes, that's right. But people like Jim Wilkinson were still there, and they'd worked with Turing on the design of the pilot ace. And when I was there, the manufactured version, the ace, was what was being used, and the deuce as well. So the English electric deuce, I think it was. So they started to get money to build computers. And so the ace was in a huge room, of course, and very what we'd seen as the original technology, mercury delay lines, and huge numbers of racks of delay lines. And
describe those computers, because I came in with a Cambridge in the early 70s, and they're all already, I mean, they were still huge. It was the 370, 165, I think. And they were vast and very slow and had no memory and so
yes.
on. So, but those ones.
The ACE computer, the Pilot ACE is now in the Science Museum, I think, but the ACE that people were using to do their numerical analysis and machine translation and so on. You booked some time on it and sat at the console and looked at the green lights and tried to debug your program. So it was just a very primitive way of operating.
What was the input? Do you use paper tape or punch cards?
I think it was cards at that time, I think it was paper tape, because I went on various courses to use both, so I forget it really. But I know we had these gadgets for doing printing, punching holes in paper tape. To splice little bits of your programming in such a way.
And the programming languages were?
It was assembler.
assembly.
It was a horrific assembler because the skill was to, the instructions were going around in a delay line and took a different amount of time depending on whether there were additions or multiplications or such like, divisions being long. And you had to put the next instruction just after this instruction finished. So part of your opcode was a next instruction. Where's the next instruction to go? It is incredibly complex. It is a skill that became obsolete very quickly, as many things that we all learned as the years went by.
I mean, it's difficult. At that time, you could have had absolutely no idea of what was going to happen.
No, absolutely not.
Did you sense that there was some revolution brewing?
It became evident that computers would be used for other than scientific purposes. So in the wartime, the Colossus was just not a stored program computer, it was doing the fixed code breaking. An interesting thing was Alan Turing couldn't admit he knew about all of that because it was still secret. So when he went to build the Pilot Ace after the war, they believed this would be terribly difficult to engineer and no one knew how to do it. And the people who'd been at Bletchley Park, of course, did know, but they couldn't say.
So they did it much more quickly than...
They did it, but it was difficult to convince people that without revealing what they'd done before.
I mean, how great a influence or figure in computing do you think Turing was?
He's colossal because he contributed to the theoretical side in his theory of computability in, 37? And then could do the hands-on engineering and practical design. As well, so a colossal figure. But you see, you hear that he was a difficult person, and he left NPL or the civil service anyway, and went to Manchester.
What is the Turing test?
Oh, whether you can tell whether a computer is a computer or a person if you're interacting with it blind, isn't it?
There's a trick to it. I don't know whether.
No, I don't know.
Which is that the computer has to pretend to be the opposite sex.
Oh, really?
To what it is.
Uh-huh.
So it's a computer pretending to be a man when it's programmed to be a woman or something to that effect.
Okay, right.
Which was explained to me by Simon Chaffer.
There are people at the NPL working in those sort of areas. There's someone called Chris Evans a bit later, who was very interested in that. Doing something like diagnosis by computer, interacting with people and asking what their symptoms were. So it's slightly different from the Turing test, but... Can you automate the process?
What was your exact job at the National Physical Laboratory?
It was writing programs and for numerical analysis, just sort of inverting matrices.
But at that point, you couldn't put anything in except numbers, could you?
No.
You couldn't put words in? Or?
No, it wasn't word processing. I mean, I was just employed to do numerical work.
And what... Again, just to get the viewers the enormous change. I mean, what was the memory of a CPU, for instance, of a computer like that?
I can't remember. I mean, I don't know if you'd even talk about it in terms of bytes. It'd have some sort of bit number.
Just tiny.
Tiny, yes, really.
And the sort of storage, I mean, external storage or storage on disk was also tiny at that time.
Yes, I don't remember about the Ace. The Deuce had a drum. I don't remember what the sizes were. I'd have to look it all up.
I mean, we hear about Moore's law of the doubling of computing power every 18 months. Did that operate right from that time onwards? It's certainly been operating recently.
The technology had to go through core store. Subsequent to delay lines, then transistors, and I think it's when chip development started and transistors were used, that the Moore's law kicked in and started to operate about how much can go on a board and a chip and so on.
When does that happen?
Transistors.
About 50 years ago.
Yeah, something like that.
As I've been talking to Herman Heiser and others about, and he showed me the new plastic equivalent. He said this was the first time about 50 years that he's got a new...
Okay. My favourite source, if I've got to prepare lectures on and anything to do with history, is the IEEE Computer Society timeline of computing. Alas, it stops in 1996, but it goes back to pre pre-war EDSAC, pre-EDSAC and ENIAC and Zeus and all of those very, very old machines, and all the way through. So that would tell you when transistors were invented and when this, that, the other happened. And
So where is the timeline?
I don't remember these things.
Where is the timeline?
It was created, it's on a website, the IEEE Computer Society. It was created for their 60th anniversary, 50th anniversary, beg your pardon, in 96. They've just had their 60th anniversary. That's when Maurice Wilkes had the Pioneer Award, the one-off Computer Scientist Award.
I mean, as you see in these interviews, I don't do things strictly chronologically.
Right.
Well, they will come come on back to that. But since you mentioned EDSAC, which was the computer that Maurice Wilkes developed, wasn't
That's
it?
Right.
Tell me something about that computer and Wilkes's part in it.
Well, of course, I didn't come here until 1985, so this was a long time before I was involved. So, I mean, the way I saw it from the MPL, there were three UK computing projects in progress. There was the ACE, the pilot ACE, then the ACE and the DUCE at MPL that were trying to do scientific computing and sort of practical work, moving on, solving eigenvalue problems and such like. There was then Turing's next attempt at Manchester, the baby, and there was EDSAC at Cambridge. And these three were all operating post-war in the late 1940s. And I think the baby did something in, was it 48, and then EDSAC in 49 and MPL in 1950. So they're all, I think it's just like science often is, that there is a feeling that this is the thing, that the exciting thing to be working on. And all the three projects were contributing. So the EDSAC machine, there is a website on it because we had our 50th anniversary celebrations in 1999.
And there must have been a lot going on in America too at the same time.
Yes, yes.
About at the same level.
At the same level, at the same time, yes.
But coming back to Wilkes, who we'll come to, well, let's deal with him a little later when you meet him. How long did you stay at the National Physical Lab?
Oh, very short time, only a year and a bit. I met my first husband, Mike Bacon, and we were married in, I think, 64, and then we had the two-job problem, and he moved to Dollis Hill. And again, this is very interesting with the Bletchley Park connection, because he was working in that sort of area. And so I had to find a job, and I went to GEC, Hurst Research Centre, so we could live and work in that area.
GEC was a computer company?
No, it was, I was doing aerial design, so I just went and got a job as a mathematician, so it was a bit odd. I didn't follow the development I'd started at all at that stage. So I did some work on, frequency modulation as opposed to pulse code modulation and fading problems and things like that. Where I got back into computing at GEC was using the London University Atlas. So we needed to do computing, and this was between 63 and 68, and so went up to London and used the Atlas there. That was another very interesting.
You couldn't do this remotely in those days.
No, certainly not, no. So that definitely was cards. You put your deck of cards over the counter and sat there and waited for them to be run.
Why did you have to use that machine?
Because that's, well, there are very few machines about.
And there was no problem. The university was quite happy. They presumably got paid by, is it GEC or GCE?
GEC, General Electric Company.
That's right.
So Arnold Weinstock was the name in charge,
yes.
Either then or shortly afterwards.
Yes. Did you enjoy that job?
Yes, I did, yes. Although it was very different. It's not me, really, because it was just go back to the mathematics until I started doing programming again. But I enjoyed the using the Atlas machine. Then I later came to teach all about its architecture and met some of the people who designed it.
Who designed it?
David Howarth at...
Oh, yes.
He went to Imperial. He was involved in it.
Was he here at some point? Or
I don't
know. So many David Howards.
I don't know. It's probably a name that comes up more than once.
As an MP as well as
an
audiovisual aids man.
Yes. Frank Summers as well. He was at Manchester.
Yeah. So you did that for how many years was it?
That was 64 to 68.
Hmm.
And then the kind of two body plus child problem started to arise, so I went into lecturing.
Hmm.
I first of all went to Watford Technical College because we were living in Watford.
Hmm.
And at that point we used the Elliott 803 machine at Hatfield Polytechnic.
Hmm.
I did the Masters at Hatfield part-time while I was a lecturer at Watford, and then immediately got a job at Hatfield.
Masters in Computing
Science. Masters in Computer Science. So that was my first computing qualification.
Yeah. And then you got a job?
Then I got a job at Hatfield.
Polytechnic, as it was.
Polytechnic, as it was. So that was a very forward-looking, very early into computing, had a big national presence in computing.
What did computing consist of then? I mean, you were beginning to use Fortran or programming languages?
It was still a lot of assembler, because I was teaching machine architecture at this stage, and Hatfield was just about to get the DEC System 10, a DEC computer, and so I taught that. So part of my master's at Hatfield was talking about the DEC, the machine code. And when I went to the lecturer there, I was teaching the architecture and how to program at that level. So I was at the operating system level, I taught some high-level language programming. It was just basic at that stage and some ALGOL.
Mm.
But what I specialised in was the architecture.
Mm. And by then it was pretty obvious that computers were developing very fast.
Very, very fast, yes. But still mainframes at that stage.
Mm. What was the most exciting thing about that development at that time? Was it that you were moving from numbers to language?
I don't know if there's one thing. It was just everything was always changing and having to acquire new skills all the time. And seeing it's difficult to remember when you didn't have a computer on your desk, but how you got computer time. How you queued up for it, or all of this kind of thing, just all of that happening, and then suddenly things become so much easier, and you didn't have a mouse, of course, in those days.
No, I was just about to start at that time.
The technology.
It was a nightmare, and you had to wait for such long periods. You had to go off for a meal while something was happening, and then come back and find it in a sort of cubbyhole somewhere being printed out your results.
That's right. And you didn't know how long to book, because you may need only a couple of minutes if it went wrong, and then the rest of the hour was free and all of that.
Hmm. Were there already kind of computer techies, I mean people who were totally bound up in the world of computing? And I suppose it was more difficult with the mainframe. You couldn't sort of do it all night and all day. Among the students or staff?
The students, I think all of us are very interested in computing and developments. I mean, Hatfield is a very good place to be, and loads of people there were really good.
Mm.
And the people who taught me became colleagues. And
yeah, were there any in particular who you remember?
Roger Sharp was head of department, Gordon Bull was very dynamic and forward-looking, John Lewis, very competent, very aware of academic politics. Very good people.
Good atmosphere in the department.
Very good atmosphere in the department. It was not huge at that stage.
Mm.
And I think there was a lot of pressure to expand after I left in 85.
Mm. I mean, the thing that's always interested me about my computer friends is that they seem to have a pattern whereby they work very, very intensely for quite long periods or shorter periods. And then they stop, and then they go off to the Eagle and drink a large amount of beer.
Yes.
That's based on just one or two cases. But
two,
was there that sort of atmosphere there? In other words, there was relaxing?
I think there probably was, but I'm not that type. I don't go to the pub after work.
Mm. You never have?
Never have. Oh, well, I did try a bit when I first came to Cambridge, but I didn't for very long.
Because I've always thought or guessed that the same thing happened there, of course, with DNA and so on, that this sort of tension between very heavy concentration and working rather alone and facing problems, and then coming, relaxing, drinking a bit, talking, and then someone in a slightly related field being able to say, oh, well, you say you've got this problem, maybe you might be quite helpful in something like computing.
It works very well, and I encourage the students to talk to each other as much as they can, and the postdocs and the PhDs and the RAs. But myself, I tend to work very hard at whatever I'm doing, and I suppose what I do is go and paint intensively after I've finished working intensively.
That's your form of unwinding.
That's my form of unwinding.
Mm.
And so, yes, going back to Hatfield, we had the mainframe, but then we were early into buying a mini, so we had a little mini computer built in Stevenage, and then we went on to the 68,000 as a teaching machine, so we had many of them in the labs, and I was involved in teaching that.
The 68,000 is a sort of, it's not a desktop, but it's a sort of mid-sized thing.
Yeah, it's a small mini. Well, I suppose a microprocessor, yeah. It's a long time ago, and you forget the classification.
They weren't being joined up by this point in any way.
When I started doing my PhD, because the potential for them being joined up was beginning to be realised. So in the 70s, we started having local area networks, which I guess Andy Hopper will have talked about.
Yes, he has.
Cambridge Ring.
Yes.
Going back to the MPL, it's an interesting place in that in the mid-60s they invented packet switching, Donald Davis, and interacted with people in the States who were building the ARPANET, which became the Internet. So the MPL has been a very influential place over the years.
Was Berners-Lee connected with us at all?
No, I think he's much younger.
Yes, because he'd sort of worked on packet switching or something like that.
I don't know what he did before he did web browsers and protocol for doing hypertext at CERN. I think he's a lot younger than me. I don't know.
And all of us.
Yes.
Okay, well, you were now, this is the 70s.
Yes.
Where were you? Were you still at?
I was still at Hatfield till 1985, but I did a PhD. And I got that in 81, and I got interested in connecting computers together. I was just using simple connections, using serial lines, but was aware of the developments in Cambridge with the Cambridge Ring and in the States with the Ethernet, and you could see that was the way to build networks. And so instead of the packet switching wide area networks that were slow and unreliable at that time, there was this move towards local area networks that were being developed at Cambridge.
Mm. Was Cambridge ahead of America at the time?
No, very much interconnected. Mm. So Roger Needham went to, first of all, Xerox PARC and then DEC regularly over the summer, and had great friends there who were working in computing and exchanged ideas. So I don't think there was a competition. I think there was...
Because Andy's account of, which I've also heard from Herman, same account of Bill Gates turning up and looking at the Cambridge local area network and saying, "What's this? I've never seen anything like this," suggests that Cambridge was rather ahead of what Bill had seen anyway.
Well, I don't know. I mean, there were places, Xerox PARC was very, very much ahead doing its Ethernet and doing the... And what they did is put a workstation on everyone's desk, although nobody could afford it at that time, just to see what happened. So Palo Alto Research Labs, that's what they did. And the Alto Computer, then the Dandelion and the Daybreak. And a lot came out of it, but I think there were problems because they didn't exploit it commercially. And so Apple very much arose out of Xerox PARC.
Just pause on that link. I mean, how did it arise out of?
Because they were starting to develop good human interfaces to computers, the mouse, the icons, and so the research background, I think, to what turned into Apple was all evolving at Xerox PARC over the years for. Goodness, I use one of those machines, but I've forgotten the name of the interface, the GUI. It'll come back to me.
Was Jobs at Xerox? Steve Jobs? Was it Steve Jobs who started Apple?
I don't know. I guess so.
Well, there was a direct link.
Yes, I have to look that up. The IEEE timeline would tell us, I think.
The Your PhD was actually on networking, was it?
It was on distributed systems. Yes. So it's looking at the operating system kernel and how you included communication and how you had processes running on distributed components interacting with each other. So it's looking at the potential of not just one program on one machine just running and getting an answer, but when you needed more than one machine, how you got the components interacting.
Who was your supervisor?
It was Adrian Stokes.
You're smiling. Who is Adrian Stokes?
He was just someone at the Adrian's background. What is he now? He's in the National Health Service. He was a King's Fund Fellow after he became a lecturer at Hatfield for a while. I think he came to be something like a postdoc. At that time, very few people had computer science PhDs, and Gordon was perhaps an obvious choice, but he was already supervising every PhD in the department. So I needed someone with a PhD, so Adrian, I thought, would be a good supervisor, and we worked on having students do projects that contributed to the PhD, things like that.
And it went pretty smoothly, and you got your PhD in...
I got a part-time PhD in 3 years, and they weren't ready for me.
That's very fast, part-time particularly.
Yes, I was able to, a lot of the work was project supervision as well, so I could get code written by project students and incorporate it.
You mentioned you were teaching at Hatfield. I mean, what kind of teaching was it? Lecturing or supervising?
I was a lecturer. So I went lecturer, senior lecturer, principal lecturer. It seemed a huge teaching load when you compare it with lecturing separated from supervision here. So I guess I was lecturing, I had a load of something like 15 hours a week, but this could include splitting up the whole group you lectured to into several tutorials and having them do case studies on operating systems and that kind
of
thing.
So it was 15 hours contact time.
15 hours contact time.
Yep.
I think that may have been as a principal lecturer at the time, I can't remember.
Do you enjoy teaching?
In a way I feel I've been there and I've done that. I did when I was... I hated the idea at first. I thought I'd be far too nervous, and I came to like it after about 5 years. And I guess for a period of about 15 to 20 years I quite enjoyed it, and then I got to the stage where I felt I've been there, done that, and I'd rather concentrate on the research grants and other things.
Did that change to the last phase coincide with Cambridge, or was it after you got here you decided you had enough teaching?
I think it was partly the way that the teaching's organised here, in that I was lecturing at Hatfield to people that I knew in a group of, say, 10 to 15 for tutorials and seminars, whereas when I came here I was lecturing to, say, 80 to 120 people I wouldn't see again unless they were in my college and I was supervising them. So you did feel a bit more detached from the students when lecturing, because I've got a quiet voice, I don't naturally interact with a big lecture. I'm rather suspicious of it, because if there are 80 to 120 in the room, I don't really want interaction. Because the ones who ought to be interacting aren't, perhaps.
But when you came here, I mean, we're jumping ahead a bit, but when you came here, did you also you mentioned your college, you supervised in a college as well.
When I came here, I was very ignorant about Cambridge. I wasn't here as an undergraduate, and I think Roger Needham suggested I might go to Newnham, and I felt, yes, it's a women's college, maybe I should do my bit for the women students. So I became an unofficial fellow at Newnham. But I also directed studies for Newhall and Lucy Cavendish. So I was taking on the women students. But then over the years I realised that there were very few in computer science. And so at the end there were no students at all at Newnham some years. So I moved to Pembroke to direct studies across the road to have a cohort to work with. And then in 1997 I moved to Jesus as a fellow.
Is computing taught, or perhaps were you teaching computing or mathematics really?
I've always been teaching computing.
Now, is that taught by the usual supervision method of one or two students who you supervise.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you enjoy that kind of teaching?
Yes, yes, I very much enjoy that, yes. Mm.
And you set them, perhaps not essays exactly, but problems.
Typically what might come up in exam questions or what has come up in exam questions.
And they write something. And then.
And they write something and you look at it and they bring questions from the lectures and you can go through them.
And you continue to enjoy that kind of teaching?
Yes, very much so. Yes.
And you because still do it?
Yes, yeah, you know the people. Yes, I still do it.
Mm. But do you still lecture? Or?
Yes, oh yes.
Mm. So despite the fact you're a bit...
It's a bit of an ordeal, so I do it as well as I can.
Mm. The other side of academic life is administration, and I think you were saying that you had enough of that too.
Administration. I do a lot of external professional service. I don't know what we quite define as administration.
Mm.
I enjoy certain committees, so I'm on various appointments committees and promotion committees. Are you being asked as a token woman, or do they really want you there? And it's the same with external professorial panels, I think, things like that.
You do find that a bit of a added stress?
I don't know. I think you wonder, but I mean, the few I've done, I felt I was there in my own right.
Mm. What about in the college?
In the college, and I think I was quite old by the time I went there, or perhaps I should say senior, so I tended to be put on things like appeals committees. I'm on the university appeals committee, not that it meets, the stipend review committee, things like that, where they want someone a little bit more experienced, perhaps.
Mm. Yeah, and you quite enjoy those things, though.
Yes, I enjoy things like that, yes.
Mm.
Yes. I think we all grumble about box ticking and process that has expanded over the years.
Mm. Right, well, let's return to the sequence of your life. You were at Hatfield till about 80?
85.
85. And then what happened?
Then I moved to Cambridge. I got my PhD, I think that was 81, and carried on working, lecturing in the same area, and supervised a couple of PhDs at Hatfield. I got a research grant, yes, that was a big thing, in that there wasn't the culture that everyone knew about research councils and how to get grants, and I've no idea how I came to know about you can apply for grants, but maybe someone suggested it. So I got a small research grant, and then started to go to it was the CERC in those days, the Science and Engineering Research Council, and they had workshops. And so everyone working in distributed computing came together quite regularly. And these were very good things for me because I was at Hatfield, very teaching orientated, although I tried to go in the research direction. And then I suddenly met people from everywhere at the CERC workshops.
Mm.
In distributed computing, so I went to a lot of those and met everyone, and then I suppose this gave me the confidence to think, well, I could apply for jobs, it's time to move on. And I happened to just open the Guardian one day, and there was an application, a job advertised for Cambridge, and also one for University College London, so I went to both.
You applied to both, but you got into both, and then
I got into both.
And decided on Cambridge.
I had to decide between commuting from Watford to London every day or whether I'd go to Cambridge. And I thought, I'll try Cambridge, find out what it's like. Because I'd always rather regretted not going to Cambridge as an undergraduate.
Had you? Hmm. Had you met any Cambridge people at these sort of CERC meetings? Or?
I'd met Cambridge people throughout, really, at the MPL, at GC. There were two Cambridge mathematicians, and well, Jim Wilkinson at MPL was sort of way ahead of the Trinity. There was a maths tripos as a Trinity student when he was an undergraduate. And he was very, very clever. So I kept coming across these brilliant Cambridge mathematicians, which made me realise for the first time that it's actually a very good place rather than something for public school children, which I'd not really understood when I was at school.
Mm. Had you met lots of brilliant Oxford mathematicians as well, or not?
No, I hadn't, no.
So Cambridge is...
Cambridge began to feel very special, and gosh, I missed a chance when I was at school and not going there.
I didn't quite catch your last comment about grammar school. It's sort of, because this is an interesting theme, I mean, had you felt that perhaps Cambridge was a place where it wouldn't be so easy to fit in with your background?
Yes, yes, I did feel like that. It was because I'd been in the sixth form for years, it seemed, and I was ready to go, and I wasn't ready to stay another year to do a Cambridge scholarship.
Yeah.
Although I'd done the Latin, so I could have, for we needed Latin in those days, so did that just in case. But I was ready to go, and my friends who were perhaps a bit older were already going, and so I just didn't try. I did feel I was more working class than some of them, and it wasn't for the likes of me.
Yeah, that's what
that
I was.
That was the thing.
Yeah, I was wondering yes. about. And was that reinforced when you came here or not?
No, not at all.
Really?
Oh, yes.
Say it loudly.
No,
our Vice Chancellor needs you, your voice.
That's right. Yeah, I met people like Ken whose friends were from all over the world and from the Northern Grammar Schools also, and he'd directed studies in King's for ages, and he'd had people from Northern Grammar Schools all the time, and King's had always been into outreach, and so I found it was not at all like I'd expected.
No difficulty at all?
No difficulty.
And you never had it since?
No.
No. Do you think that's general, or do you think computing science and mathematics and maybe the sciences are easier for, because there's a common language and...
It may be. Going back to the reunions that I had with people I was at school with, someone last summer said, oh, the people I was competing against to try and do languages in Oxford, they were so much better educated. They'd been to the lycée, they spoke fluently from birth, or, you know, all things like that. And she certainly felt that she wasn't on a level playing field.
I think even in the 70s, 80s, it was changing a lot, wasn't it? But some people who I've interviewed did find colleges particularly rather odd. And, you know, for instance, I'm sure he won't mind Dan Brown, who came from Glasgow when he first came to Christ or wherever it was. He found it pretty intolerable, you know, very snobby and conservative and ritualistic and so on. But you never felt that?
I ended up at Jesus, and we had David Crichton as master, who sadly died, and then Robert Mayer as master, and they're both very much mathematicians, engineers, my kind of person. Colin Renfrew before those two, just overlapped a little bit with him. Newnham was too much like Royal Holloway, so...
On the edge and all women.
Yes, that's right. So it wasn't really the place for me. I did try to help the women students, but as I say, there weren't enough of them.
What were you mainly working on when you came to Cambridge? What was it still in distributed?
It was still distributed systems, operating systems at the lower level, rather less as the years went by, but distributed systems.
And what were the main developments in the, this is the late 80s and 90s?
Later 80s and 90s, I had a project in filing systems, how you might have distributed components with multimedia was becoming just about possible with computers, and so how do you store that and how do you deliver it in without jitter and fast enough and so on. We were also getting on to the stage where we started off saying software needs to communicate, so the source of any communication was always a software component for quite a long time. Then we got to the stage where we're monitoring the environment, where things happen. You know, just at first there are mouse events in a single computer, but these are sort of coming in unpredictably from outside. And this has moved on to sensors monitoring the environment, or medical sensors monitoring people for their health. You know, looking at their body symptoms to see whether they're all right. Traffic monitoring. So we've moved to the paradigm where events are coming from outside the computer system, and we've got to respond to them. So it's what's called an asynchronous paradigm, instead of just components are just interacting to get the job done that's pre-specified and known in advance.
One of the things that's probably related to that, I talked to Ken, my husband, about occasionally, I remember some years ago he used to refuse to fill in his census because he said he didn't know what they were going to do with all these questions.
Right.
And he's always been nervous about data surveillance and so on, with talking of censors and other things like this. Is this something that you've been interested in or worried about at all?
Yeah, that's a different thread. Access control is something my group's worked on access control for quite a long time. And we've worked with medics on electronic health records and how you specify who should be able to see what data. And the special thing about healthcare data is that it persists, its sensitivity persists for a lifetime and longer. So if you have, say, cancer records, something like that, it's not like a battle where the data's confidential for a day and then doesn't matter who knows what, it's confidential indefinitely. And so you have to really worry about how it's encrypted. If it's encrypted, does it actually get transferred in encrypted form? How long are those keys going to be secure? Enough bits as time goes by to be secure. Maybe you don't even send all the data outside where it lives. You have to anonymize it or fuzzify some of the fields and make sure that you know certain records all relate to the same person, but not that anybody can see which person it is outside where the one place where the records are held. So issues like that.
Given all your attention to this and other people's attention to it, it's the obvious question, why is it that there have been recently so many disastrous releases of medical and other data?
Yes, I mean, we've always known that the highest bandwidth way of transferring data is on, used to be a disk, now it's on a memory stick, and people not taking care. So laptops are portable, memory sticks and disks are portable, so as soon as you get huge amounts of data on these devices, you can just carry it around, and if they're not careful, then it gets lost. Whereas our research was just, if you're trying to transfer a tiny part from a database, be very careful what you do.
Is there any way of preventing this?
It just has to be human processes, I think.
It is a human problem, there's nothing to do with it.
I think so. The devices are so portable, and there are so many of them, and they're so, you know, you can hold so much information on such a small device.
Given the amount of information that is now being collected on us and will be collected and synthesized together, is there any assurance that this won't flit off to the Russian mafia or elsewhere?
It is very scary, I think. The human element is the weakness, I think. I suppose you just have to store everything encrypted, make sure it's not allowed to go onto laptops that have sensitive data without being encrypted.
But are they doing that?
I hope so. I mean, the company who lost the data recently have been dismissed as auditors or whatever they were doing.
But there have been several losses, haven't there, in different forms?
Yes, all of similar kinds.
And that's just accidental losses. If there are very large sums of money to be made by sending your people into these places to work and then take away things, I mean.
Yes, industrial espionage and so on. It seems it's become too easy to get large amounts of data.
Let's turn to one or two people in Cambridge who you got to know. You must have known both Roger Niederman, Karen Spark-Jones. Tell me something about them as people.
Roger was head of department when I came to Cambridge. In fact, well, he interviewed me along with several others. Roger and Karen were very kind and helpful when I first came and had me around to dinner, and they'd built their own house in Coton.
I have an image of two houses next door to each other. Is that
filled with books? Possibly, but I think her mother lived in the second house when I first came, but she died sometime later.
What sort of people were they? I mean, intense?
Karen was very, very trying to do things all the time and came over as quite dogmatic, really. Definite is the word. And she'd come and say, Jane, what are you going to do about this? You better do something. She was genuinely interested in computing and,
Our main work was in natural language.
It was in natural language processing and information retrieval, which of course came into its own when the web was invented in the early 90s.
Hmm.
Before that, it was closed collections in libraries.
Hmm. Information retrieval has been the field that Ken and I have worked on
mm-hmm.
together. Is Cambridge an important centre for the development of that?
Information retrieval? Well, I suppose Karen's group, the Natural Language Processing Group, yes, but I didn't associate the kind of IR with Cambridge before I came. There was someone called Sultan at Cranfield who did, who wrote a book on information retrieval way back in, must be the 1970s.
It wasn't COD, and that was databases.
That was databases, yeah, this was Sultan at Cranfield. I'm sure Karen knows all of these people, but it was so easy then because you had a closed collection. You knew what you should have retrieved and what you didn't retrieve that you didn't get. And on the web, you have no idea what you didn't get. So it's quite a different problem.
Have any of the early programs in probabilistic or Bayesian retrieval and so on gone, developed in Cambridge, been important at all on the web?
I don't know, it's not my area. I think Keith van Rijsbergen has taken the more statistical approach to IR further.
His work is important.
His work's important.
And Martin Porter's.
Martin Porter's, yes. Yeah, it isn't my area though, so I knew of the group, Steve Pullman and Karen, and then Ted Briscoe came later, but I've never worked with them.
And Ken was mainly working on database systems.
Yes, that's right. I did actually work with one student on an MPhil project for the natural language processing because we wanted to be able to express who can access which electronic health records. And we worked with Steve Pullman, and you could say something like, only the doctor who is the registered doctor for this patient may see the health record, and you could write it in what Steve called discourse diagrams, and then you could turn it into predicate calculus, and then you could generate code from that, Java code, I think. So there was one project that did allow us to interact with the NLP group, but that was my only experience. So it was trying to express policy. So there is a human language element, obviously, in trying to say what policy you want for who can see what on the web. And it was an attempt to controlled English, I think. To mind that was being used.
Talking about the predecessors and the successors to Roger, I mean, the predecessor was presumably Maurice Wilks.
It was Maurice Wilks, yes.
Tell me something about Maurice.
Maurice is extremely courteous. He's always been so nice to me. I felt like, you know, I was unknown and this person coming into his laboratory. And I thought he was always extremely nice.
A good organiser.
A good organiser, a brilliant lecturer, and still is a brilliant lecturer. And he's so good, he gives out the diploma students.
He started the diploma, didn't he?
He did, yes.
The first in the world.
Yes, the first first course in the world. And
that was in the, late 40s, early 50s? Early 50s, perhaps.
Yes. He's just given the final set of diploma certificates out.
That's a historic course, isn't it?
Yes, very much so. It's a pity it's finished.
Yes, why is it finished?
Oh, because the government wanted master's training programmes instead of conversion courses. And our diploma has converted so many wonderful mathematicians and physicists and scientists of all kinds to computing. It has done an enormous service, and they go and get jobs now as physicists and mathematicians and scientists and just do the computing without being educated in it. So I think it's a great pity that course is finished. But it was 5 years or so ago we lost the 20-something studentships, and the course has then declined since then.
Same thing happened in another project.
Right.
Though we still use the MPhil as a double, as a conversion and as a topping up, but we conceal the fact, perhaps.
Yeah,
yes. No, not really. What was Wilkes, as a computing person, how high is his standing?
Oh, it's the highest, really. He's, first of all, a pioneer, but then he's kept up all his life, all the way through. And when you think he's retired before I came to Cambridge, and he's still lecturing.
Yes. Well, he's grandson, so to speak, Andy Hopper, says that, you know, when Morris comes in, he asks him very penetrating questions.
Yes.
And he has to think carefully.
Yes, be very careful, yes. Oh my gosh. Put me on the spot there. And David Wheeler was the same.
Was he?
He was extremely, he was a brilliant person.
Was he the head of the computing?
No, David wasn't.
Mm. But he was a very important figure, wasn't he?
He was a very important figure. Really.
He worked with Srinivasan Dhar, I think.
Did he? Okay. Mm. Right.
Tell me about David.
David, he was again a very, very nice person.
Mm.
Very courteous again, supportive, but he was just a brilliant mathematician and brilliant at security.
Mm.
So again, I don't know enough to speak very knowledgeably about his work, but you know, David had such a high reputation.
Mm. And then your current head of
Andy
Hopper. Yes. Tell me about Andy.
Well, he's a brilliant head of department. It's great to have him around.
Mm. I mean, he's a representative of a phenomenon which, according to Herman, was encouraged by Roger Needham, which
yes.
was not being too picky about allowing people to both work for the university and develop.
Okay, right.
Which Herman said was one of the keys to the Cambridge phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's probably right, yes. I was so sorry when Andy left us to go to engineering. It was awful that happened.
Mm.
And then we were so pleased to have him back.
Mm. Why did he do that?
I think that it was who gets a professorship.
Mm.
So there were two professorships advertised, one in the computer lab and one in engineering. And it was timing of interviews and who gets offered what when.
Mm.
So Ian Leslie and Andy both got chairs.
I see.
And Ian was in the lab, computer lab, and Andy was in engineering.
Mm. But then he came back.
Then he came back to be head of department after Ian went to be provost chancellor.
Hmm. How does Andy, I mean, I got some impression from interviewing him, but he does so many things. He has, you know, he's on the board of a number of these science
mm-hmm.
companies, and
mm.
he flies around the world all the time and
yes.
does this and does that.
Yes.
He must be a man of enormous energy and...
In energy and inventiveness. I think all the way through his career, almost... the things that came out of his research group and his companies were just things he'd thought of. The active badge, you know, here
mm.
am I, the door
mm.
opens when I approach it and
mm.
I can log in and send my message or send my environment to the nearest computer, find out where my badge is. I mean, Andy just dreamed all this up.
Mm.
And yeah, all the location technology and such like.
Mm. What about, I mentioned, I think possibly, the plastic logic and the
mm-hmm.
new generation of transistors.
Yeah, I don't know that.
You don't know
that. I'm not a hardware expert.
Because mm. that's
mm.
probably going to have a big
mm.
effect.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it's tying up with people who Andy knew as a physics graduate. In,
oh, okay, yes.
Like Richard
mm-hmm.
Friend and,
mm.
and Herman Heiser and
oh,
so on.
Oh, right, yes.
Have you
yes.
had any... dealing with this sort of huge fringe of activities around Cambridge, which are many of them tied up with the computing laboratory?
Not so many. No, we've interacted with clinical and biomedical computing,
mm.
who are in the same place as Carrot, who you mentioned
mm.
just
yeah.
now, for the electronic health records.
Mm.
So not so much the Andes spin-off companies.
Mm. Are there... ever difficulties of conflicts of interest and so on? In
no, I haven't come across any problems.
Mm.
And we make our software available from the research grants. We just put it on our website and it's downloaded by people who want to use
mm.
it.
What
so
do
I
you...
Think, yeah.
Sorry.
So I was going to say, I think I'm a bit too old to have been in the spin-off a company generation.
Mm. Mm. Well, Ken said he'd only once done some sort of consultancy which had earned him some money, but
right, okay.
he didn't.
Yes.
Tell me something about your partnership with Ken. I mean, you don't work on the same computing problems, but the fact that you're both computing people presumably
mm-hmm.
gives you a lot to talk about.
Oh, we work on the same research grants.
You do?
Yes.
Mm.
I suppose this is how we got together, really.
Mm.
Distributed systems. So he was in databases and I suppose was interested in distribution and concurrency
mm.
control and And so there was an overlap in interests.
Mm.
And I suppose over the years we got research grants together and the interests sort of coincided rather more as the years went by.
Mm.
So I was in operating systems, he was in databases, then I moved to middleware and distributed computing, and he was interested in distribution. But he's a good theoretician as well, so he can give the theory courses.
That implies you're not a good theoretician.
I've not kept up, I'm de-skilled as a mathematician.
Oh, but he teaches maths, I mean he's director of studies.
It is amazing, he's kept the maths going and he can do the exam questions. And when a new set of exam papers comes out, he sits there and makes sure he can do them all for the students he's supervising.
Gosh.
So
he's such a modest person, he would. I'm glad you told me.
Right. That.
It's sometimes quite difficult if you're exactly in the same field. There are advantages, but also it's difficult to know when to cut off from work and so on. Have you ever found that? I mean, when you're wandering through the Pyrenees, taking photographs of flowers, are you also discussing?
Not very computing? Often, just occasionally.
Hmm.
It has worked extremely well. I think we got together as much through me trying to find nature reserves when I came to Cambridge as through the overlapping of interests at work and trying to find somewhere to paint, and King's had a studio. So, yeah, several different things.
Tell me something about that side of your painting. I mean, you said you started pretty young, but...
Yes, I've always somehow tried to paint, whether it was an evening class or just something all the time.
Mm.
So when I came to Cambridge from Hatfield, I was trying to find somewhere where I could just keep this going once a week or something like that. And King's had, I think they had a donation from somebody, and it allowed them to appoint not an artist in residence as such, but someone to do teaching.
Mm.
I think you've had both concepts, haven't you?
Yeah,
artist in residence, and I'm not sure what the title is, but we still have. John Stubbs has just been appointed to replace Rose Rance, who died. And so I worked with Hermione Holmes at first, and then Rose Rance after that. And at that stage, I'd never had exhibitions. It hadn't occurred to me, but Rose was so encouraging, and Rose and Nelson, that I did this. And it was something to really work for. And I think it's a great thing, because it sort of focuses you, and you do work for it, you get a set of work and you put it up, and
it clears it away.
Yes.
You don't have to start again.
Yes, that's right, it's a focus, and it gives you confidence if you feel, gosh, I'm not too ashamed of that.
It's rather a nice combination, because yours are very beautiful, mainly nature subjects, and Ken, I didn't know, but he takes photographs of an overlapping kind. Has he always done that? Or was it through
your
interest?
Yes, he's always taken photographs. Yes, I think the flowers was something he came to do because I was interested, so he would take the flower photographs for me. But he would do butterflies and birds more recently when he got a camera that could actually take the birds.
Mm.
He's done a lot more of that. But the reed bed project over the last two or three years has been a joint project, because we moved to Suffolk. Ken sold his house in Knaphole, 300-year-old thatched cottage.
Mm.
We were spending most of the time in my house in Cambridge, so I sold Ken's cottage, bought a house in Suffolk near the coast. And of course there are reed beds there, and they're just so wonderful, and they all through the year, the way the light falls on them, in January the light's low, you get wonderful effects. And I got very interested and asked him to take photographs, and he did this all the way through 2005.
Mm.
And then I started the painting project after that.
Mm.
And he's still taking reed beds since 2008.
So is that how Ken is more or less retiring now, isn't he? And you're retiring?
I have another 2 years officially, before I should retire.
Mm.
Excuse me. I got a frog in my throat.
Let me just...
New research grant starting in October,
hmm.
and that goes on for 3 years, and two new PhD students, one on the grant and one on a case studentship, so that's 3 years commitment, so although I'm supposed to retire in 2 years, I may at least try and linger on the lab, just doing the research for a further year.
You enjoy it?
I very much enjoy it, yes.
So one retires in, it varies from subject to subject. I mean, can you go on if you bring in new research grants, or is it difficult?
Yes, I think so. I mean, it's been such a privilege to work with the bright young academics as postdocs and young lecturers. I think I'd miss that terribly, and would like to carry on doing it for a while longer.
How many PhDs have you supervised?
I was just doing my CV the other day, 37.
37, and we're about equal, I think.
Right, yes.
And a lot of MPhils and so on.
Okay.
You don't find it stressful worrying about them and when they don't, when it's not going well, or when they can't get jobs, or...
I always worry about them. I worry about whether I've done all I should have done and things like that, but I think getting jobs isn't a problem.
No, you're in a good field.
In a good field for getting jobs, yes.
Just one sort of last general question. Having watched this amazing development of computing in the last 40 years, and having been part of it myself, all one can say is that early, at any stage, one could never have predicted what was going to happen next. So it's an unfair question to ask you to predict what you think will be the exciting things that will happen in the next 10 or 20 years.
But I don't know about 10 or 20. I mean, the exciting things that are happening at the moment are, in my sort of level or lower level now, is the fact that a single computer is a multiprocessor. So I've always worked in concurrency control. I wrote a book called Concurrent Systems. I've had PhD students sort of in that area, and there is one currently doing very good work on sort of threading architectures, and this is coming into its own because instead of having a single processor per computer with a memory, you're now always going to have two or three or four or many computers, many processors, so you need to be able to exploit that, and it's difficult because the concurrency means that they may be interfering with each other's data, unless you take steps to avoid it. So that's one problem that has to be solved, and it's sort of come around full circle.
Because many computers like the Apple G5 has dual processing.
Yes. Well, for a long time you could assume one machine was one processor, so you could solve concurrency problems simply.
And that's going to increase the power hugely.
It's going to come, it's going to make software go wrong. Particularly if you let application programmers program parallel systems, make mistakes.
Just one last note. I noticed that you didn't have a computer, or at least certainly not an internet connection, in your house in Suffolk.
No.
Are there times you had to be away from machines?
Yes, it's just very relaxing to go to Suffolk, because in my house in Cambridge I've got broadband, and I'm logging on all the time, so after supper I'll just check email just to see if everyone's all right. But in Suffolk you feel as though a load's gone off your shoulders as you go down there, because there's no television and no internet, lots of music, lots of walking, and it's very nice.
It is indeed very nice, and I enjoyed our time with you, and I'd like to thank you very much indeed, Jean, for a lovely
thank
interview.
You.